but at least one English artist, cartoonist Wilfred Hawton, refused to cross a wartime ocean. At most, someone could work 9 sunlit hours a day, 6 days a week. Disney had been all about working harder. That was now illegal. "Let's get the draft board members over here," Walt theorized. "They think we're just making Mickey Mouse. We'll show them what else we're doing." Much of what they were doing involved demonstrating technical specs of weapons not in the field yet. This was considered classified intelligence work. The ink on people's fingers were from fingerprinting. You used to need an appointment to get onto the Disney lot. Now you needed a security clearance to get past the posted Coast Guard police. And the budget restraints. Back in the day, Disney could easily spend $80,000 on a single short. The Navy was paying $80,000 for 20, and they were all due in 90 days. It was a sprint the length of a marathon. Walt said yes, not sure how he'd do it. Disney somehow met that deadline, and that budget, and without overtime. 20 cartoons and the time and expense it took for one. Auteurs need not apply. What was important now was getting the most usable work from every pair of hands. Men like Ub were running the show now. The studio, Bob Thomas reported, went from producing 30,000 feet of film in a year to 300,000, a tenfold increase. Animation cameras were in use 24 hours a day. This was in no way the Disney House style of animation, which according to a 1942 chart, was a 14-step process. Disney quality had given way to iWorks quantity. Walt couldn't get 300,000 feet of film pencil tested, much less fully animated. Here was Ub's chance to shine. Efficiency, craft work, and geometry. Ub iWorks saved Disney Studios at a time when Walt and Roy were both passing the buck by refusing to sign work orders because it was the other guy's job. Without commotion, without notice, he transformed Disney back into iWorks Studio. Departments were condensed. Animators would write, lay out, and direct their own work, then ink it, paint their own backgrounds, and check their own errors. Reports said a scene would only leave a particular unit to be photographed. Animators become solo artists again. New cheap ways of doing things were invented. Sliding cell and pivot cell animation, not used since the cutout doll days, worked well to show a ship plowing through an ocean. Filming a maquette model worked too. In some instances, the newer ways have proved even more effective visually, Walt admitted in a training manual. Ub was one broom who had become legion. More than any other person, Ub helped produce the work the military needed. He was shaving days and weeks off training schedules, finding ways to produce more film with less animating, and he did so with a humbleness bordering on stealth. Even in the animation world, few knew Ub was heading the animated war effort. Just like in 1929, Ub stepped up to save Disney. Ub iWorks had a secret. Everyone assumed his name was Dutch, but the Frisian people lived in a swath of land between the Netherlands and its neighbor to the south, Germany. The iWorks came from the Rhineland side. That would explain Ub's Teutonic efficiency. A German engineer was effectively running Disney. A photograph of Walt and Ub working on one of the military films doubles as symbolism. Walt is seated, a foot on a stool, pointing to the cockpit of a model airplane. He's talking to Ub, and his shadow almost completely engulfs Ub's face and body. Only Ub's hands are visible, jotting down Walt's instructions. Ub was always in shadows, the man in the room everyone forgot was in the room. Speaking of forgotten, Mickey Mouse found a way to serve despite only appearing in 2 Disney films in 1942. He pitched Sunoco products in an ad that doubled as a war bond endorsement. So did Minnie, appearing in a 3-minute-long Save Your Grease short. Meat dripping sink Axis warships. Every little bit helped. Or did it? Almost every economic endeavor was being rebranded as a war effort. The world was catching up with Disney's salesmanship. Ordinary purchases were now being touted as ways to win the war. A morning bowl of cereal was now a patriotic duty. Mickey was a 20-year veteran of such efforts, serving as club leader for many of these campaigns. There were Mickey Mouse ration books, Mickey, Donald, and Goofy hits to their factory jobs, and a gas rationing poster, "Planes Need Gasoline, Share Your Car for Your Country." A Mickey poster for Victory Gardens, with Mickey giving a green thumbs up, heralded the three V's, vegetables, vitamins, vitality. Mickey enlisted domestic help in the search for spies, the aircraft warning service. "Look, listen, speak only to your post commander," went another warning poster, with Mickey cupping his glove behind a prodigious ear. Mickey let a nation feel as if it were helping. One terrifying way Mickey merchandising and the war intersected was a product of the Sun Rubber Company in early 1942, available in the UK since the Blitz. Over there, the fear of a gas attack was real, but gas masks didn't fit snugly over smaller heads. In a chemical attack, children wouldn't be safe. Hence, the Mickey Mouse gas mask. The Mickey Mouse gas mask looks like a prop from a Marilyn Manson video. It attaches to a child's head by six straps, two of them extending from Mickey's ears. Mickey's eyes are glass, and his snout is extended just enough to resemble an actual rodent. A cylindrical filter sits below Mickey's chin. Not many were made, and luckily none needed to be used. But time and again, Mickey Mouse would show up as a cultural cynosure of American involvement in the war. You may not have heard the name Horst Rosenberg. He was a French Jew sent to a Vichy concentration camp called Gurs for the crime of existing. While there, he made pamphlets that poked fun at his situation. An innocent person locked away. One piece was a Baedeker-style tourist book explaining the sites for vacationers. Rosenberg is most well known for Mickey au camp de Gurs, a book that puts Mickey Mouse in the concentration camp. "My first impression was rather bad," Mickey notes. Even the title page contains a mordant joke. Published without Walt Disney's permission. Making light of the Nazi regime in such a way was a death sentence if he was caught, but Rosenberg must have figured he was already caught. That the book still exists is extraordinary. That it's a solid work of satire is miraculous. In the summer of 1942, Disney premiered Bambi. It was the best picture I ever made, and the best ever to come out of Hollywood, Walt said shamelessly. By design, Bambi was graceful, slow-paced, and sober, words not usually used to describe cartoons. Nor should they, some harsh reviews noted. Mickey wouldn't be caught dead in this, the New Republic snorted. Variety was kinder. The glow and texture of the Disney brush reached new heights. It fell inches short of breaking even, remarkable for being basically a domestic release. Bambi was destined to become a classic, which, as Mark Twain fans know, means a movie people praise but don't watch. It was nominated for three Oscars, launched a generation of animal rights activists and conservationists, and begat the Bambi effect, where environmental damage was explained via how it affected charismatic megafauna, that is, cute animals. Disney lent Bambi to the U.S. Forest Service for a year's worth of fire prevention ads. When the year was up, the Forest Service made a new character to replace Bambi, called Smokey Bear. Bambi, like the other cartoon features, would be cellared into the Disney vault like a fine wine, growing more potent in the dark. The ideal Goldilocks interval to uncork the vintage, Disney's sommeliers found, was 7 years. That was long enough to charge full price, short enough to not leave people's memory. If you missed Fantasia in 1956, you'd have another chance in 1963. Also released in August was Saludos Amigos, the José Carioca film. It premiered in Rio and would see stateside release early in 1943. It did well enough that Walt didn't bother asking Nelson Rockefeller for his promised government subsidy for the trip. The El Grupo trip also helped Walt in making The Winged Scourge, an educational film about how the Seven Dwarfs combat malaria. It would play frequently in South America, and is certainly the only film to include the line, "Attaboy, Dopey! Kill her good and dead." There may not have been a single moment in 1942 when Walt and Roy decided Mickey should take a breather in the vault, but with the war continuing, hope was a rationed commodity. A focus on Pluto, Donald, Goofy, and even Figaro the Cat made no room for Mickey. He went from two films in 1942 to one supporting role in 1943 to having a feature film canceled. Nothing for 1944. Nothing for 1945. Nothing for 1946. Absence was the kiss of death for an actor. The mouse was exterminated. Roll the stone over his tomb. War made other well-known characters disappear from public life. Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio weren't playing baseball, and James Stewart and Tyrone Power weren't up on screen. Of course, they all had enlisted. Mickey was just cooling his heels. But his absence was still felt. Wartime America was no longer the country of Mickey Mouse. Maybe it would be again, but right now, there was a collective loss of innocence. Mickey in himself wasn't funny. He was cute, Walt said. So the situation had to make Mickey funny. Now, when the duck came along, the duck was just the opposite, and he was created to give us another character, an opposite personality. He was comic within himself. He supplied something that we just couldn't do with Mickey. It's always revealing when someone accidentally talks about themselves. Walt had spent the last decade turning Mickey into a homunculus of himself. Now he thought it was boring. There's an infamous Walt quote. "I love Mickey Mouse more than any woman I've ever known." It's been used to highlight everything from Walt's lack of respect for his wife to his desert island faithfulness to her. But it also explains why Walt never gave up on the crafty mouse. They were twinned souls. Mickey's merchandising remained immense. According to internal figures, Disney-branded merchandise moved $100 million worth of product during the wartime era. That's over $1 billion in today's money. Millions of toys were being sold as a tie-in, not with a film or a short, but the past. A Mickey purchase was a time machine to when you were eight, when the world was better, and selective recall made the streets cleaner and wallets fatter. Nostalgia was a perpetual emotion machine, and Mickey was its biggest beneficiary. "Mickey is forever," Walt said. The same lack of conflict that made him hard to write made him an ideal corporate mascot. The mouse was timeless now, locked into a yellow pre-war stasis. Even his barnyard location was a thing of the past. Most Americans now lived in cities or suburbs. The world was at war, and wartime demanded new heroes. The super patriot Captain America, Bill Maudlin's infantry dog faces, Willie and Joe, and the inane Kilroy Doodle all came from World War II. Mickey the Square Peg was a mouse who didn't fit in the bullet hole world of the big one. War characters might have a shelf life that ended at the ceasefire, but for the nonce, the blackout was their limelight. New Disney stars would fill the war gap. For 20 years, British pilots blamed mechanical errors in their planes on gremlins, invisible poltergeists who caused mischief. For an animator, the idea of telling an air combat story with sabotaging imps was too rich to pass up. It'd be perfect for a hybrid of live action and animation. Walt heard about the gremlins from a visiting Royal Air Force pilot. This fighter ace had been through the ringer. He had split his skull and temporarily blinded himself after being shot down in the desert, and he had to crawl clear of the wreckage before it was incinerated. Crippling headaches eventually forced him to leave active service. When writer C.S. Forrester asked the pilot for details on flying life, he found the notes so well written, such the work of a born storyteller. He published them as is. That was how Flight Lieutenant Roald Dahl got into the writing business. Dahl had been posted to America, and in his spare time wrote a children's book about gremlins and the RAF. Walt Disney Studios was always looking for new talent, and a stateside British ace with a smashing story was irresistible. It even had a great ending. The hero pilot Gus wins favor with the gremlins, and sends them to sabotage Nazi planes. Dahl loved life in Los Angeles, and L.A. loved Dahl back. He acquired the nickname Stalky. Dahl was a big friendly giant at 6.5 feet tall. Accounts say he got along well with Disney's men, and especially women, during his weeks there. I was put up at Disney's expense in a luxurious Beverly Hills hotel and given a huge shiny car to drive about in. I had a ball. Hollywood was the ideal place for a 26-year-old playboy war hero, especially one with a movie deal. Walt had his publishing arm acquire the Gremlin book and premiered the work in the December 1942 issue of Cosmopolitan. He wrote a jokey letter to the RAF, asking them for a gremlin to be crafted and shipped it to California. Before its release, he started the storyboard process. Soon the screen would be filled with images of Hawker Hurricanes being ripped apart by Widgets and Fifinellas, two of Dahl's delightful names for gremlin species. Despite the cartoon not being finished, Fifinella became a breakout star. She had horns, blue wings, moxie, and curves. The Women's Air Force Service Pilots, WASP, was the first group of many to ask Disney if they could use images of her. Fifi became a new Disney star, a modern girl just as capable of fighting as a man, while still being stylish. If Walt was able to keep the company afloat through the war, he might emerge with a new leading lady. Chapter 35. Snafu. 1943. Families and business of the enlisted put up service flags during the war years. Each star pinned to it represented another son, another father, another employee, over there. In the 1943 dispatch from Disney's newsletter, Mickey Mouse used a rare four-letter word to describe Disney's. "We now have quite a service flag, and all of us here are damned proud of it." The newsletter was meant for staffers serving overseas and featured new drawings of pinup girls. In a year's time, that Disney service flag would feature 165 stars, including 5 gold stars representing the dead. Due to Disney's work with military training films, Walt was offered a chance to join the Army Signal Corps. This may have been a ball-hogging attempt by the Army for Walt to be all hoo-ah all the time. By 1944, Charles Solomon reports, the Navy had 1,000 training films in production at any given time. Some of those were from Disney. Walt declined the Army's honor. Any power he had was due to his people, he explained. Making him an offer wouldn't change anything. He said no, but Frank Capra said yes. Capra became a major and headed up a military division in the 20th Century Fox lot. Major Capra led what was called Fort Fox. Fort Fox held what may have been Hollywood's all-time greatest writing staff. Under its Quonset hut roof were 3 future Pulitzer Prize winners in John Cheever, Lillian Hellman, and a pre-Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel. The authors of Lassie Come Home and Ferdinand the Bull. Novelists William Saroyan and Irving Wallace, and an animation dream team of Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, Friz Freleng, and Frank Tashlin. Capra, a prolific director, was stymied by the gridlock of the War Department. He was stuck in endless meetings in Washington, D.C., a continent away from his camera. Capra rang up Walt one day, eager to make a movie instead of just discuss making one. That led to Capra's heralded Why We Fight series, which was co-produced by Disney and filmed on the Disney lot. It also featured scattered animated segments, a Nazi blot taking over a map, an enemy radio tower broadcasting the word lies, Emperor Hirohito as a kamikaze pilot. Capra wasn't the only one who wanted things back to normal. The iWorksization of Disney was beginning to irritate Walt. He liked throwing money at a project. Now it was all being done dirt cheap. For efficiency's sake, ink girls were now timed. Inking a Mickey cell, for instance, couldn't take more than 5 minutes. That meant 12 Mickeys an hour, 108 a day. One animator remembers being told he had $17 a foot to make a war film. A miserable rate. He found a way to make it for $12 a foot, giving Disney a nice little profit. When Walt found out, He was torn between pride and shame. "Don't you think you could have spent a little more dough," he said, "and got him a little bit better?" Better, though, referred to entertainment, not animation quality. These military films were, in their own way, as challenging as Bambi. No cheating, no stretch or squash, just rotation of three-dimensional objects, cutaways to see the inside of a gun barrel, and morphing wing shapes. Ub was throwing personality animation out the window. Michael Barrier found that in 1943, a whopping 94% of Disney footage was for the government, paid for with only half of its production budgets. It was a new thorn in Walt's side. Ub's work had no laughs, miserable profit margins, and was the only thing keeping Disney afloat. For that reason, Walt was probably happy to have been underbid for a Fort Fox series of instructional cartoons. They were intended as personality animation, starring a goofy-esque character called Private Snafu. Snafu was a military expression. Situation normal, all filed up. Leon Schlesinger won the rights to the four-minute comedies, which were produced in a harsh 6-week time frame. This work would have been a much better fit for Disney than cross-sectioning rifles, but Disney wouldn't have been allowed to own the copyright. Besides, Walt didn't like the view from the top of the slippery slope of contract underbidding. He hadn't benched Mickey Mouse just to go chase dimes in the gutter. Making Private Snafu may have been the necessary pressure, a decade's worth of experience in 3 years that gave Warner Brothers its post-war brilliance. Its animators came out of war a band of brothers, albeit one never in any danger. Snafu received an honorable discharge, but his voice lives on. The enthusiastic lisp Mel Blanc gave him would be recycled for Elmer Fudd. While Mickey waned, Donald waxed. Der Führer's face, maybe the definitive World War II cartoon, features a chorus of brass raspberries and Hitler receiving a tomato to the face. The majority of the cartoon displays real sympathy for the residents of the first country Hitler invaded. We see what a day in Herr Donald's life is like. His alarm is a marching band of grotesques. His breakfast is a piece of toast-shaped wood, a single contraband coffee bean, and a perfume spray of bacon and eggs. He works punishing hours in a munitions factory. His vacation is looking at a painting, and every other second he has to say, "Heil Hitler." When Donald awakens to find he's back home in the U.S. of A., he kisses his copy of the Statue of Liberty in gratitude. Walt made extra copies of the film to be dubbed into Russian. The agitprop was prop-planed across the border and parachuted into Soviet theaters. The Russians had pirated Disney films for years. Now Walt was helping pirate it for them. The Russians also appropriated imagery of Nazi spiders crawling over a globe for its own propaganda. Der Führer's face was dubbed into German as well, and scattered through the Reich. "We heard that Hitler burned every copy he could find," animator Jack Kinney said. "We loved that." Another Disney effort proved to be more than just a morale booster. Walt read a 1942 bestseller called Victory Through Air Power by an expat Russian pilot named Alexander P. Desiversky. Desiversky's book preached the gospel of preparing for an inter-hemispheric war direct across oceans. Walt was convinced whoever controlled the skies would win World War II, but the upper echelons of the military disagreed. They still believed the war would be won on the sea. Walt was only too aware of how damaging to Disney it was to bite the hand that feeds you. "The Secretary of War is liable to come out tomorrow and contradict the whole damn thing," he said, but he was convinced the only way to beat the Nazis was from above. And his conscience wouldn't let him stay silent. Victory Through Air Power went smoother than Walt's other aviation project, which fittingly enough was beset by its own gremlins. The world had fallen in love with Dahl's little monsters. Even Chaplin acted out gremlin scenes for Dahl in L.A. The Gremlin book was destined to be a hit, and the movie was well into expensive pre-production. So what was the problem? Dahl. Another RAF pilot had claimed that Dahl stole his Gremlin idea. Dahl responded by magnanimously agreeing that half his profits go to the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. It was one more sign Dahl was a manly paragon. Dahl had claimed gremlins were an RAF legend. They weren't. Everyone who flew knew about gremlins, not just the English military. The word gremlin might even be German in origin, not English. Much of Dahl's book featured old pilot legends, which he had claimed he had made up. It would be as if Walt claimed Snow White was an original story. Over the years, many of Dahl's stories proved false. He was never shot down, for instance. He ran out of gas, and he didn't crawl from the wreck. A compatriot flying next to him landed and pulled him free. Yet he titled his war memoir, Going Solo. Why was he stretching the truth? He really was an ace fighter pilot, though, with 5 confirmed enemy planes shot down. Why pad such a glowing resume? Dahl's behavior was an issue, too. He had grown adamant about the smallest details. When discussing the gremlins' hats, for instance, he insisted they be green derbies. Nothing else would do. He also didn't like that the gremlins looked cartoony, or that they were friendly instead of fierce, or that they were used for a Lifesavers ad. He kept threatening to shut down the project if he did not get his way. At a production meeting with Walt, he filibustered with war stories until a tired Walt bowed out at midnight. When Walt invited Dahl to the studio to firm up the story, Dahl refused to go. Directors would be canned for acting this way. Dahl was the writer. If Dahl was purposefully trying to sabotage the project, he succeeded. The Gremlin film was never made. The last straw may have been a clause giving the Royal Air Force, not Disney, final approval of the film. There wasn't even enough usable footage to assemble a short, which speaks to Dahl's proficiency in throwing what his fellow Brits called a spanner in the work. Walt never truly let anything go, and patched some Gremlins footage in Victory Through Air Power. Where Walt failed with Gremlins, Bugs Bunny succeeded. Bob Clampett's Falling Hair, a Looney Tunes short from October 1943, features Bugs Bunny doing battle with a gremlin. Bugs also reads a book called Victory Through Hair Power. Ain't he a stinker? Audiences laughed at the fast, cheap, and good animation. But stealing characters and ideas? Of course this meant war. Or it might mean industrial sabotage. Cartoon studios had come up with a gentleman's agreement to avoid the twin film problem. Walt had told competitors the year before that he was working on Gremlin films. Termite Terrace had taken the word Gremlin out of the Bugs Bunny title, but still released it. Were they too late to stop production? Were they trying to beat Walt to the punch? Worse, were they so damnably fast enough they cranked it out after they heard the Roald Dahl deal fell through? It ended up being unimportant. By 1943, Gremlin mania was already fading, but the potential leak was a matter of national security. For instance, in North Africa, American film crews recreated a tank battle in order to get better newsreel shots. They never told their allies that footage of brave Yanks in action was a safety-zone recreation. If word got out Americans were falsifying their courage on the world stage, it could damage the special relationship between the USA and England. Add to this that Walt had picked a fight with the brand new Pentagon, opened in 1943, over air power. The War Department's view was that this was a sea war, with limited use for planes. Walt's argument otherwise would be believed by many. But what if Walt was wrong? What if he persuaded the right people to make the wrong choice? Midway through production of Victory Through Air Power, a trusted art director named Ken Anderson approached Walt Disney. In a smooth gesture, he removed an incendiary device from his pocket, held it to Walt's face, and detonated it. "What the hell are you trying to do, burn me up?" Walt roared, his mustache aflame. It was an accident. Anderson had a new untested lighter and was offering Walt a light. Amazingly, Walt Disney did not fire back by letting Anderson go. Instead, the next day, a clean-shaven Walt took him out to lunch. One of the few pieces of brand real estate Mickey Mouse held on to in the war years was Walt Disney Comics and Stories. He was always the cover boy and the lead character as well. But in 1943, Donald Duck took over the comic book. That started a 25-year reign of mind-blowing adventures. Just as print Mickey was different from screen Mickey, Print Donald was different as well. He was completely intelligible and not as quick to anger. An in-betweener named Carl Barks became Donald's writer and artist. Barks's work inspired a generation of fans. Two film school brats named Steven Spielberg and George Lucas even wrote a treasure hunt adventure to be as much like Barks's Donald as possible. Not bad, considering Barks never signed his name. He was known only as the Good Duck Artist. One of Mickey's vault friends was paroled in 1943. Brand new editions of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs were rolled out in the UK with a new ad campaign. Millions will see it for the first time. Don't you envy them that thrill? Universal saw similar success giving its undead monsters, Dracula and Frankenstein, a second life as well. War-era audiences loved it. They loved anything. You could run film backwards through a projector and people would look at it, one saying went. And not just look at it. Audiences believed every newsreel, even cartoons. Victory Through Air Power was released to a predictably weak box office, but it was seen in the corridors of power. RKO refused to release it, because so many newsreels, dramas, and comedies had given audiences war fatigue. Disney ended up distributing it through United Artists in July. By August, the film had changed the world. The change happened in Quebec City, where FDR and Winston Churchill were planning exactly how to invade Vichy France without losing the element of surprise. Churchill was a convert to Dessevierski's plan, but he couldn't convince Roosevelt. In a chicken-and-egg moment demonstrating air power, Churchill had a fighter jet fly a copy of the Disney film to the conference. It worked. Churchill swayed FDR, who then swayed the Joint Chiefs. The entire invasion of France changed to align with Dessevierski's mandate for air superiority. They all better be right. Walt wasn't the only dopey drive denizen with the president's ear. Roald Dahl had rebounded from his animation gig to the White House. Eleanor Roosevelt, a fan of his writing, invited him to dinner. That led to games of poker with Senator Harry Truman and a weekly tennis match with Vice President Henry Wallace, where they quite sincerely discussed writing a screenplay together. Social climbing doesn't get more stratospheric than the president's inner circle. There were no hard feelings, Walt wrote to Dahl in December 1943, as plenty of ideas at Disney never crossed the finish line into production. I have personally endeavored to generate some interest among the various crews, but haven't met with any degree of success. However, if we ever hit upon an angle that seems right for production, we'll get in touch with you. Dahl left Disney on good terms. Roald Dahl was a British spy at Disney. While Dahl's wartime espionage past is known, most don't go so far as to say he was actively snooping for wartime plans while at Disney. To do so opens a can of worms. It suggests Dahl's writing career began as a ruse to spy on a friendly nation, and that he kept up the ruse long enough to snoop out as much data as he could, then hissy-fitted his way out of Disney to schmooze his way into the White House. But consider the alternative. A British spy lies to get himself placed in a position of power in a war industry. He has access to classified information of troop movements and invasion plans. One soundstage was hung with storyboards on how to invade Iwo Jima. Once inside for a few months, he goes from cooperative to belligerent, is let go, and miraculously talks his way into a second position of wartime power. But the spy only spies the second time he foxed his way into a henhouse. Dahl had leveraged his Disney connection as much as he could. When it was time to move on, he acted like such a pill that people were glad to see the last of him. He was one of hundreds of British operatives working in the U.S. Another such spy, Dahl's future friend Ian Fleming, made a career writing about such dashing work. British spies had been stateside for years, trying to force America into entering the war first, and then staying in. The British Ministry of Information, for instance, was sneaking American troop information to the creators of a popular boxing cartoon, Joe Palooka. Joe's story had him fighting in Tunisia. Thanks to British intelligence leaks, he would stay fighting in the desert as long as they told him the Yanks would be there. This wasn't legal, but it helped boost U.S. morale. Most spies' lives were dull. They cozied up to people in positions of power and ensured their support for the war didn't waver. For committed isolationists, though, the spies would turn to blackmail to force their hand, and there were few better ways of information about a man than via his wife. Put it this way, when Fleming wrote of James Bond's ways with women, he may have based them on how Roald Dahl conquested his way through Los Angeles and Washington. Dahl, normally a rakish blabbermouth, was always cagey about how much of his American jaunt was spycraft, and how much mere kibitzing. He never admitted to spying at Disney, for instance. But Occam's razor has only one explanation for why a spy would make a beeline for a building filled with classified intelligence, lie his way inside, and then cause a ruckus to get kicked out. Dahl would become an acclaimed short story writer before discovering his true calling, children's books. He's darker and nastier than Walt, and Walt was the man who killed Bambi's mom. Dahl's Disney tenure ripples through his work, notably through his main characters, who are little more than proper names that readers can wear like masks. That was Mickey's MO as well. When you read Matilda or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you become those characters just as much as you become the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Dahl took more secrets from Disney than just classified information. Chapter 36, Overlord, 1944. December 1943. American Captain James A. Fairbrother, new to a British RAF base, wanted to make a big here-I-am statement. He climbed into a P-51 Mustang, which had a cowboyed-up Mickey Mouse on the nose. Fairbrother flew up into the cloud cover, then proceeded to dive-bomb his own base, knocking the caps off a shocked crowd. This was called flat-hatting. And it was killing almost as many Allied pilots as the Luftwaffe. These stupid, pointless deaths had to stop. So Walt Disney was asked to do the impossible, make something dangerous seem uncool. The short flat-hatting put the daredevil pilot on the analyst's couch. It showed how he had always been rewarded for his thrill-seeking actions growing up. But in the Air Force, things were different. Mowing the flowers off their stems, weaving between telephone poles, and banking perpendicular to fit through alleyways would lead to a court-martial, if not an early grave. Captain Fairbrother, by the way, kept his wings despite flying like a Section 8. You can read about his exploits in Len Deighton's World War II novel, Goodbye Mickey Mouse, whose title contained three references in one. First is Fairbrother's plane. Second is that plane's namesake, a pilot named Michael Morse, who was nicknamed Mickey Mouse. The final reference is the military lingo, Mickey Mouse. It was a bureaucratic mess. For enlisted men, a Mickey Mouse movie was a film about personal hygiene. A Mickey Mouse trophy was what you won when you didn't come in first. Wouldn't Goofy have been a better fit for ineptitude? Mickey could not be in a war film, Walt knew, without ruining Mickey and possibly Disney. He did not want to pull a Chaplin. In 1940's The Great Dictator, Chaplin broke character to deliver an impassioned anti-Hitler speech. That's what you get for stealing the tramp's mustache. The speech ended both the film and Chaplin's career. Audiences did not want to be lectured by actors, even if they were right. Walt publicly distanced himself from his one-time idol, telling the New York Times that Mickey Mouse's politics were not Chaplin's. Neither were Walt's. He became vice president of a new group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, whose pre-McCarthy goal was to encourage films without communistic ideas. Spokesman Ayn Rand, yes, that Ayn Rand, called for Hollywood stories that did not celebrate the common man, that poo-pooed the power of teamwork, and that never pitted lone heroes against wealthy business owners. Basically, it banned Frank Capra movies. Must have been awkward when Walt ran into Capra on the Disney set. Strangely, the person Ayn Rand and the other members of this Hollywood silent majority seemed to be calling out the most was Mickey Mouse. Mickey, after all, was a prime example of a commie, perpetually unemployed, always butting in to cooperate, not enlisted, seemingly living with an unmarried girlfriend. Was Walt Disney calling his own alter ego a Pinko? Pinko Mickey might still have been better than the Mickey some French viewers saw during the war. This was not a Disney-made film. It was in shoddy black and white with subpar sound and animation quality. Another noticeable difference was this film had Mickey as a Nazi stooge. The documentary, The Eve of Vichy, captured the propaganda the Vichy government used to try to brainwash the French people. Americans, the French were told, were good-hearted but easily manipulated. Coincidentally, that's also how the Nazis saw the French. And there was no better totem to represent America than its cartoon heroes. One such Vichy cartoon begins with a safe and happy French family tuning into the wireless for news. This is London, a grotesque Jewish stereotype says. Be patient. We're coming. Cut to a wave of British and American planes filled with not-so-funny animals. Goofy looks like he's about to retch. Felix the cat is a tail gunner, equally nauseated. Mickey sits behind the yoke of the cockpit, ready to bomb the City of Lights. Isn't this France? Mickey asks, pointing to a map of the area, with Paris highlighted. Yes. Bomb them, Donald Duck replies, in a credible duck français. Mickey, Popeye asks with regret, is it true they have better spinach in France? No one here is evil. Just deluded. Then it's bombs away time. Made in USA explosives rain down indiscriminately, missing Nazi targets and striking the French people. The wireless listeners get excited that they'll be able to have steak and fries again, right before the house and all in it are destroyed. When the smoke clears, only the wireless is left, still reciting broken promises. The Nazi propaganda brought up one salient point. When exactly were the Allies going to cross the English Channel? The answer would come soon enough. Thousands of officials were involved in Operation Neptune, a secret plan to arrange the largest seaborne invasion in military history. One of the passwords to gain entry into the meetings was Mickey Mouse, possibly because, due to the naval fleet attacking the town of Isigny-sur-Mer, the map was labeled Mickey Mouse Diagrams. Operation Neptune presaged Operation Overlord, a month-long land attack plan. 2 days after the famed D-Day invasion, a Wire article reported the trivia about Mickey Mouse being a swordfish-esque password for one of the meetings. That claim began the rumor that Mickey Mouse was the trigger phrase for the entire invasion. The mouse did not have that honor. There was no trigger phrase. The invasion was determined by a combination of the tides, a full moon, English Channel chop, and the desire to not wait another 2 weeks. French citizens waiting for the invasion were stuck in a Kafkaesque nightmare. Everything was supposedly normal in this police state, and if you acted otherwise, you might have to deal with the Gestapo. Parisians needed a brave face. They were ordered at gunpoint to act casual. This dress position affected all aspects of life. For example, the French-language Disney magazine, Le Journal de Mickey, was canceled, and Mickey's strips in Le Petit Parisien were replaced by pro-Nazi news. But Disney's head of French distribution was not allowed to close shop and leave. The Gestapo felt that Walt Disney Studios had become a war propaganda bureau for the Allied powers. They stopped regularly at the Disney office, hoping to find some contraband evidence. When they didn't, they moved on to harassing the distributor in the street. He was able to escape one such round of bullying, thanks to a hidden Mickey. The distributor spotted a Mickey Mouse painted on a Nazi patrol car. He grabbed onto this doodle like a life preserver. If Disney was truly anti-Nazi, the distributor pointed out, then Herr Mickey would not be on their vehicle. But there it was. Therefore, Disney couldn't be anti-Nazi. The logic worked, and he was allowed to return home unmolested. Then Donald Duck had to Heil Heil right in Der Führer's face. After seeing that cartoon, the Gestapo barged in saying that Nazi-land was proof of Disney's anti-Nazi views. The distributor played innocent again, confessing to not being sure what Walt's feelings about Nazis were. I'm here, and Mr. Disney's back there in America. That night, the Gestapo broke into the distributor's office and destroyed every scrap of film they found. Luckily, the distributor was one step ahead of the goose steppers. He had hidden all the war films off premises. What the Gestapo incinerated were nothing but ratty Mickey Mouses from the early 1930s. Hitler had already seen those. Joseph Goebbels gave him a Christmas gift of 12 Mickey film strips in 1937. Back in Burbank, Jack Sawn was completing arduous work on a film about how planes could communicate with each other at night by blinking strobe lights in a code. This would be necessary to coordinate positions for pattern bombing. A platoon of British and American soldiers heard about the film and quickly ordered the work print thrown in the incinerator. Jack Sawn was heartbroken. His best work wasn't good enough? That wasn't the problem, though. Jack Sawn's work was no doubt fine as always. The soldiers had recently learned about the actual Allied attack plan. They couldn't tell Jack Sawn. He didn't need to know. But they could save him from wasting time with a nighttime tactics cartoon. The attack, the soldiers knew, would come at sunrise. In the pre-dawn hours of June 6, 1944, over 11,000 planes took off from 100 ersatz air bases scattered around the English countryside. The takeoffs were elaborately staggered to avoid crashes. Many of the bombers took off from RAF Swinderby, an airfield in the Lincolnshire town of Norton Disney. A few hundred years ago, some Norton Disney men set out to Canada to make their fortune. Their descendants, including Elias Disney, carried their town's name. There were even more threads connecting Mickey to the invasion. For instance, Royal Navy minesweeper ships were nicknamed MMs or Mickey Mice. The bombing panel and selection switches in RAF planes were nicknamed Mickey Mouses. And one of the bombing targets for planes, Isigny-sur-Mer. One town carrying the Disney name bombed another. Unrelatedly, June 6th was the day that special Series E bonds were sold by the War Department. Purchasers were given a certificate of thanks featuring Mickey and 20 of his Disney friends. Once inland, air power gave way to a ground war. Allied soldiers couldn't tell who was who. A Nazi in a dead American's uniform could say, "Howdy," then kill a platoon. Troops used challenges and response, and if you didn't know the countersign, you were in trouble. One common question was, "Who is Mickey Mouse's girlfriend?" This, too, could backfire since Germans watched Mickey cartoons. Better was, "Who's Pruneface?" He was a Dick Tracy villain. Saving Private Ryan featured a captured German nicknamed Steamboat Willie, who tried to bond with his American captors during the invasion by talking about Mickey Mouse. As the attack progressed, Germany found itself in a trash compactor of an unwinnable two-front war. Its Eastern European territories were a bulwark holding back Russia's forces of Stalinist communism. The territories had no love of Nazism. They just hated Stalin more. Germany needed that wall. To keep it intact, it created a diabolical plan nicknamed Operation Mickey Mouse, where they kidnapped the son of a Hungarian politician and held him in a concentration camp. The politician recanted his peace treaty with Russia at machine gun point in exchange for the promise of releasing his son. The Nazis didn't give him back. Back in America, Walt was having problems that dog-faced grunts could only dream of having. A U.S. re-release of Snow White was scheduled in Cincinnati, but Walt didn't want to lose a weekend to attend it. Roy suggested Walt could fly out for the evening, but Walt didn't want to go at all. Local lads promised an Uncle Walt walk-on, but he never showed up. Quick-thinking Disney PR men blamed the no-show on a flight cancellation. So much for victory through air power. Floyd Gottfredson also decided he needed a break. His hand was as deft as ever in creating the daily newspaper world for Mickey Mouse. But dreaming up the stories was too much. With no on-screen version to adapt, and a war on, delivering years and years of stateside war adventures was too much. Every few months, he was matched up with a new gag man, but none lasted. The comic strip and publicity departments used to share a bungalow, so Floyd remembered a funny coworker from publicity named Bill Walsh. Walsh became the latest guy who pitched Mickey gags to Floyd. That humble job led to Walsh becoming, in Of Iwerks' words, the most creative man at the studio. Walsh inherited Ub's old position of Walt's right-hand man, doing the heavy lifting so Walt could focus on new projects. As Majordomo, Walsh brought Disney to the television, producing the Christmas special hour-long color broadcasts and the Mickey Mouse Club. He also wrote and produced dozens of features, including The Absent-Minded Professor, The Love Bug, and Mary Poppins. All through those years, Bill Walsh kept plugging away at gags for Floyd to draw in the Mickey Mouse strip. How? That plotting alone was too much for anyone else in the studio. Yet one of the busiest men in show business did it in his spare time. Perhaps that was the secret to Walsh's success. Having Mickey stories cogitating in his cortex at all times gave all his other work the Mickey-ish flavor it needed. The year ended with the end of the war in sight. Mexico City saw the premiere of The Three Caballeros, a follow-up to Saludos Amigos, featuring José Carioca, Donald Duck, and a new friend, the Mexican chicken Panchito Pistoles. At an almost $2 million cost, it taught Roy a new Spanish word, El Bomba. Plans for a third Latin American film, Cuban Carnival, were scrapped. In an essay titled The Artlessness of Walt Disney, The Three Caballeros is called a bad film but a good nightmare. One of the reasons for the huge expense were sequences where characters mixed it up with live actors. In one scene, Donald jumps into a dance party in Veracruz, cutting a rug with local dancers when they start playing a Norte Americano favorite, the Jitterbug. In another scene, Donald and José chase a beautiful singer through a storybook world. The singer ends up smooching Donald so passionately, his feathers go flying. The trick of this sequence was that there was a different trick each shot. For one camera setup, the cartoon was done in advance and rear projected. The singer, Aurora Miranda, Carmen's sister, had to maintain eye contact with a floating null space on set. Other shots were filmed traditionally, with the animation added afterwards. Some shots had both rear projection and an overlay of animation on top. The live action would be sandwiched in between. Short actors were cast to stand in for the cartoons, their bodies covered up with 24 frames of duck or parrot. Occasionally, the actor's shadow or silhouette was animated to align with the cartoon reality. Some shots even used the multiplane camera, focusing in on distant humans, making the cartoon co-stars blurry. That was all Ub Iwerks. His mastery of photographic processes allowed for innovative shots and brilliantly crafted effects sequences. He designed the shot progression like an illusionist, advancing the story while simultaneously dazzling those trying to peek behind the curtain. Ub was having a wonderful war. He had settled into a job that seemed precision-lathed for him. He was his own boss, as he would readily brag. He reported to Walt himself, who would give Ub a straight yes or no answer to whatever he wanted to do. No wavering, no committee meetings, no BS. He may have been the least managed person in the studio, which was not accidental. If the 10-year absence had taught Walt and Ub anything, it was that some people worked best hands-off. He was given his choice of offices and chose a tiny one that was close to the machine shop. With free rein of the studio, he was able to tinker with whatever he wanted, optical printers, traveling mats, or sodium cameras. Over the years, he became one of the world's greatest special effects technicians. Alfred Hitchcock even borrowed his talent to get some of the trick shots for The Birds. If you saw something on screen back then you hadn't seen before, it was probably because of Ub Iwerks. The price of admission for this wonderful life was falling on his sword. Ub paid that price. Let Walt wear the crown. Ub had come to peace with being a vassal in the Magic Kingdom. Questing after absolute power could be as bad as attaining it. Who said you needed UB to spell hubris? Besides, it was quite comfortable behind the curtain. The name on the studio was Disney, but the vast amounts of footage being produced was an accomplishment that only Ub Iwerks could produce. Chapter 37. Pencils Down, 1945. It wasn't just France that saw bastardized Mickey preaching their government's values. Japanese audiences, too, got to see its own ersatz Mickey Mao. The Japanese were among the world's biggest Mickey fans since the beginning. Some reports had Mickey second in popularity only to Emperor Hirohito. They knew how the mouse was supposed to look and act. If the Vichy Mickey was the stuff of lawsuits, the Japanese Mickey was the stuff of nightmares. A 1934 cartoon called Picture Book 1936 was made to show the dark future if Japan didn't stop American imperialism. It opens with Felix the Cat playing with a turtle on a peaceful island as a bobble-headed tiger dances with some girls. They occasionally look up at passing planes. Then they see one that makes them quiver with fear. Up in the sky is not a bird, not a plane, but a satanic Mickey Mouse. He rides a giant vampire bat that looks just like him. The bat writes out 1936 in skywriting, then drops a threatening scroll. Felix burns the scroll, and the flames rise to singe Mickey. He retreats, but returns with hundreds of bats, snakes, crocodiles, and bombs. Mickey kidnaps a girl. In response, the tiger bangs on a large book featuring the boy hero, Momotaro, a Japanese fairy tale character known for his animal friends. Momotaro and a zoo's worth of allies jump out of the book, and the battle is joined. By the cartoon's climax, Mickey has fought a baseball bat duel with a samurai in the clouds, and his bats have been exploded into shredded skeletons. After Mickey gets skewered with lightning bolts from the devil, he ends up feeble and withered. The animation is a bit dated, but not half bad, and some of the gags jumping on bullets like rocks in a stream are Disney-worthy. Defeating Mickey, the synecdoche of American values, was proof of Japanese superiority. This sort of self-serving hyperbole was almost all Japanese people heard about their world. There's a placebo effect to propaganda. Even if you know it's wrong, it still works. Pearl Harbor was thus portrayed as an act of self-defense against America, the aggressor. Japan was the mouse that roared. American cartoons roared back. In his star-making debut, Up in Arms, Danny Kaye plays a drafted hypochondriac. Producer Sam Goldwyn wanted the finale where he single-handedly defeats a Japanese platoon to really pop. Goldwyn hired Disney to add animation to a comical attack scene, showing silkworms eating through the ropes the Japanese were using to mount their attack. UB animated it and included a bit where the worms, nicknamed Weavy Weavies, ate through the film itself. Maybe that was too conceptual a gag, since Goldwyn cut the footage entirely. In the silent sci-fi film, Woman in the Moon, released in 1929, of course, Fritz Lang showed a scene out of a pulp magazine, a rocket that could blast out of the atmosphere into space. It inspired the infamous V-2 rocket, the world's first guided ballistic missile. The Frau im Mond herself was painted on the V-2's nose cone. What was science fiction was now science fact, and an Axis science weapon. One sequence in Victory Through Air Power showed an Allied feat of physical near impossibility, a bomb punching through the concrete ceiling of a submarine grotto like a knife through butter, exploding only after it gained access to the subs. It'd be nice if that were possible, but bombs exploded on impact. Some Disney animator had decided that a drilling bomb would show off a plane's capabilities during war. It was an overreach, and it was believed. As with much speculative fiction, the bomb wasn't incorrect, merely premature. A British inventor had designed a bomb that was long, slim, backed by a solid fuel rocket, and outfitted with a time delay switch. It was an alarm clock at Mach speed, and in honor of Victory Through Air Power, it was called the Disney Bomb. It turned out to not be very accurate, but in at least one instance, its deployment resulted in the Nazis abandoning a submarine pen. You didn't need to be in a U-boat to experience a Disney bomb, though. Nothing in the post-Snow White years was doing well. The studio's films were at best breaking even, just like the military contracts. There was no way to profit without the international market. Any more breaking even, and Disney would go broke. The Bank of America loan spiraled back up to $4 million, enough for 20 B-17 Flying Fortresses. Walt and Roy were called on the bank's carpets to explain themselves, which required an 8-hour